so you put works of art in a room together, and sometimes you realize that they're not playing well with each other, and you have to adjust. You have to, there's no science to it. It's more a kind of sensitivity that you develop. But really what you're looking for is almost the same thing, I think, as when you put a dinner party together. You have lots of really interesting friends, but not all of your friends get on. So you want to build a dinner party with friends that you know will have an interesting conversation with each other. And it's almost exactly like that when you're doing an installation in a gallery. You have this host of works of art that are fascinating and interesting, and which ones will talk to each other constructively, meaningfully, without an awful lot of intervention, so that a visitor who might walk into that space, who knows nothing about any of those artists, would suddenly say, I get this conversation, I understand what's going on, and I want to learn more. That's the goal.
Glenn Lowry has been responsible for making these conversations happen at one of the world's great museums of modern art since 1995. As the director of the Museum of Modern Art in New York City, which was opened in 1929 with the goal of being the greatest museum of modern art in the world, Lowry has guided the MoMA through a period of massive expansion, from the acquisition of works by major and emerging artists to the creation of new curatorial departments and a successful merger with the PS1 Contemporary Art Centre in Queens. They are achievements that have seen the number of visitors to MoMA more than double since he took up his post, to nearly 3 million per year. The ongoing renovation of the MoMA complex on West 53rd Street in Manhattan, which it has called home since 1932, is the latest chapter of the museum's recent history to be overseen by Lowry. The designs by Diller, Scofidio and Renfrew, along with a Jean Nouvel-designed residential tower next door, will add three more floors and some 3,700 square metres of gallery space to the museum's footprint. But despite these major achievements, Lowry says, the role contemporary art and museums themselves play in society remains a key preoccupation, something that has informed his career to date, he says, from his research into the art of the Arab world at Harvard to the directorships of museums across the US and Toronto's celebrated AGO. I'm delighted to say that Glenn Lowry joins me today here in New York City for the big interview. Well, thanks ever so much for joining us on the big interview. I wanted to start, the founding director of MoMA, his ambition, as he stated it, was to create the finest gallery of modern art anywhere in the world. Is the MoMA still that, in your view?
Well, I hope it is. Of course, there are now many museums of modern art around the world, and that's a fantastic thing. And each has its own strength. But I think what Alfred Barr was trying to do was to create not just an extraordinary museum, but a new kind of museum. And that's the real achievement, that he didn't see the Museum of Modern Art simply as a analogous institution to an existing historical museum. He wanted to create a different type of institution altogether, and that has been the catalytic dimension of MoMA, as we now call it.
And so does that thread still weave through, you know, the thoughts, the ideas, the motivations that you have as director in maintaining a place that has, since its inception, maintained a pretty singular place in the pantheon of sort of modern art galleries, modern art museums around the world?
Well, I think Barr's legacy sets a very high bar for all of us to measure ourselves against. What I took away from the most important aspect of his achievement was to think of the museum not as a treasure house, but as a laboratory, place of engagement in which the public was invited to connect not only with works of art, but with each other. And so as we've tried to imagine the museum today, we've thought about how does that laboratory function 90 years later? What are the questions it needs to ask? And for me, the museum is at its best when it's provisional, when it's not handing down the tablet of this is modern art, but rather framing questions that help people understand why artists that we are interested in are so exciting to think about.
How would you go about sort of approaching that? I'd imagine that it's quite hard that you don't want to spoon feed people who go into a museum, because part of the magic is to stumble across a painting you've never seen before, or a piece of sculpture that you thought would be, you'd be very disconnected from possibly, and to have some kind of reaction to it. How difficult a balance is it?
I often think that what we do is analogous to cooking, where you're preparing a meal that's going to have multiple courses, and each course is going to have multiple ingredients. And of course, there are any number of ingredients that you could use, but you make discrete choices because you think a certain set of ingredients are going to create a certain flavor, and that that flavor should be followed by another kind of flavor. And you build up to a crescendo. And so we think of the galleries, in a way, as individual moments in a meal or individual moments in an orchestral production, each one very satisfying. But the real impact comes in discovering what you don't know and moving from one gallery to the next, from one work of art to the next. So the way we've come to frame our thinking about the new museum, which is what we're really focused on at the moment because we're under construction and we'll be finished in a couple of years, is that we want to simultaneously reassure our audience that the great iconic works that they associate with the museum will be there, and surprise them with the unfamiliar and the unexpected. So one of the things that's happened at the museum over the decades is that each of our collecting areas, whether it's painting and sculpture or photography or drawing and prints or architecture and design, have become almost islands unto themselves, almost like mini museums, where people can go just to those galleries and not engage with the rest of the museum. And we started to realize that rather than being an advantage, that was a disadvantage, because we want somebody who's interested in architecture to stumble across a drawing that they never thought about or a photograph that they were unfamiliar with. And so we're rethinking about the actual topography of the museum to help build that notion of surprise. We're in the middle of this vibrant midtown Manhattan, and we want people to feel the energy. So how do you open up to the city? How do you create connections to the street? How do you make that energy of the street become part of the energy of the museum?
The role museums and galleries play in cities, in towns, is something you've talked about a great deal during your career. What if you had to boil it down? Should a museum, sort of in its context, be for those who are passing by or those who are passing across the threshold?
Well, I think of a museum as a fundamentally social space, by which I mean it's a space where people come to be with works of art and other people. It is not an isolated environment where you commune alone with a single work of art. Maybe it was at a certain moment in history, but museums have become so popular today that we need to acknowledge that there is a desire by people to be with other people looking at art. So I think of our role as creating conversations for our different publics with us, with each other, about art. And if we can do that in real space and online and make it a kind of continuous loop that whenever you're interested, you can kind of lock into that conversation, however you access it. On the street, through the door, on your iPhone. It doesn't matter to me, as long as that conversation is sparking and alive.
That does fly in the face, I suppose, of this kind of quite old notion of sort of tiptoeing in hushed tones kind of around a gallery, you know, don't touch, don't speak, don't this and that, and opening it up to being an experience rather than just sort of staring on silently.
For sure, that's true. And I think one of the legacies of Alfred Barr in the early Museum of Modern Art is that it was a fundamentally populist institution. It wanted the largest possible public to be excited about modern art, to believe that modern art was every bit as important as the art of the past. And that meant almost proselytizing the significance of modern art through any means imaginable. And most of the strategies we're pursuing today are tame by comparison to some of the things that Barr and his colleagues did in the 30s and 40s. I grew up as a graduate student with the idea that the museum was a revered environment where you went to commune almost as if you were before a religious object, and that distraction was a terrible thing. And of course, there's a part of me that still loves that opportunity to be alone and quiet before a work of art. But I also know from looking at what happens, not just at the Museum of Modern Art, but other museums, that people have found a way to tune in and tune out as they need to. We live in an environment where we're bombarded by information all the time. We know how to single things out, especially if we're given some tools to help us. So we have lots of conversations that are led by curators or even our security or conservation, where we just engage people in the galleries talking about a work of art. And then that helps them move on to other works of art and to focus in on interesting aspects. So I think you can strike a balance between a place that's very crowded with lots of people and a place where you can still concentrate on art. And of course, for those people who want those quiet moments, we have plenty of opportunities through membership and quiet Mondays and early hours to satisfy that need. But I get excited when I walk through a museum, it doesn't matter which museum, and I see people looking, talking and thinking about art. To me, that is the museum as a laboratory where people are discovering something.
The notion of conversations, either with someone you're in an art gallery with or to yourself in your mind with whichever piece of art you're standing in front of. For you, during your time as director of the Museum of Modern Art, which you took up in 1995, have those conversations evolved? Are there any particular exhibitions or shows that you staged that you were particularly excited by the kind of conversation, be it sort of in a broader context outside the museum or on a smaller scale in the galleries themselves, that particularly stay with you?
I do think over time the conversations have changed. First of all, when I started to talk about contemporary art, it was actually quite difficult. It was hard enough to talk about modern art. In the 20 plus years since then, modern and contemporary art have become the focus of most people's interest in looking at art. And actually, more historical art is harder to get people to connect to. So the conversations are a lot easier today because people are fascinated. Even when they see something that they don't understand, there's this sense of, I need to understand it. And for me personally, the moment I really understood this desire by our public to connect to artists and to each other occurred when we did a retrospective of Marina Abramović's work in 2010, The Artist is Present. And part of that exhibition was Marina sitting in a chair alone in our atrium and inviting anyone who wanted to sit with her to do so for however long they wanted to do. And over the course of the exhibition, literally tens of thousands of people would come a day. Now, she could only sit with a small number of them. And I kept thinking, well, what are these other people doing? How can they get any pleasure out of just looking at Marina and whoever she was sitting with? And then I started to realize they were mimicking her spontaneously with each other, that she was inviting people to connect to each other and liberating them to feel that that was a participatory way of joining her in making a work of art. And so this notion of participation and conversation started to crystallize for me as a central dimension of an experience people are looking for when they come to a museum. Of course, they're looking to also learn or to enjoy or whatever other pleasures they want to take. But this, the intensity of that bond that she made evident, I think, has become an important strategy, not just for us, but for many museums, and especially museums of modern and contemporary art.
The kind of conversations that art, very broadly speaking, let's say over the past, say, 50 or 60 years, has quite frequently strayed into the political, into the social. MoMA too has been part of those histories, most recently in February, when part of your permanent collection was rehung with works by artists from the nations on President Donald Trump's travel ban, as it's now become known. Give us a quick sense of where that idea came from, how quickly you moved to make this statement, and why it was important for an institution like the Museum of Modern Art to insert itself into a very, very sort of fiery conversation that was happening and still rolling, I guess, kind of now.
I think a lot of people on our staff felt deeply troubled by the results of the last presidential election and unsettled by it, and were struggling to find a way to make evident the values we believe in. And I had encouraged them to think about asserting our values. That's all we can do. The election took place. We have a new president. We need to focus on what we stand for: openness, generosity of spirit, engagement, a pluralism of thinking. So we were turning ideas around in terms of what was appropriate, which meant what could we find within our own collection that amplified or symbolized those values. And after the presidential ban was announced, a small group of curators almost spontaneously had this idea: why don't we make evident what this ban would preclude? They did a deep dive in the collection and discovered, lo and behold, that we had a number of works from artists who would have been banned by this order. And they thought, let's just highlight what that would mean. It happened very quickly. And I really admire their willingness to take a risk. You could read it as a political gesture, but I thought of it more as an assertion of our commitment to a global universe of artistic practices. That's what we believe in, that artists and art flow freely, that we learn from each other, that the idea that someone whose life may be in jeopardy because of the local conditions in which they live should be precluded from coming to a country that has aspired to be a beacon and home for others, manifests itself in these works of art that are in our collection. And they're here because of that belief in a modern art that could embrace different geographies and disciplines. So it happened quickly, almost overnight. And it had a far greater impact than any of us thought it would have. It wasn't meant to be a massive gesture, but I think many people found in it something so simple and so easy to identify that it took on a life of its own. And I think it's also important to say that while many felt both excited and proud, there were others on staff and on our board who felt that we might have become too political and that we don't want to turn the museum into a forum for every political issue. And what are the boundaries and conditions under which it is appropriate or inappropriate to act? And I'm happy to have that conversation. I think those are the kinds of issues that any great institution should be constantly negotiating with itself and with its public.
Going back to the idea of the election in November, I suppose one of the major narratives that came out of that, as the dust was still in the air and people were trying to make sense of what had taken place, was that conversations across the country had become more insular, that, you know, the media hubs of New York City, Los Angeles, the coasts had failed to see that a nerve was also being touched somewhere, you know, in a place that wasn't New York City or Los Angeles. Do you feel that, you know, there is an inward-lookingness happening on either side of the political spectrum, really? And I suppose I'm interested to know, you know, how something like the MoMA attracts new eyes into its gallery spaces, away from those who would cross your threshold anyway.
There are many lessons from the 2016 election that I think a lot of us have tried to absorb. The one that I've given the most amount of thought to is this notion that we're all living in our own echo chambers, that digital media in particular enables us to construct our own universe of what we want to hear, participate in, and know about. And it's very easy in that way to create your own little network and to be absolutely isolated from lots of other networks. And I think if we are going to succeed as a nation, we have to collectively get out of our echo chambers and start talking to each other and dealing with those difficult issues that divide us. So we have a role, like many other cultural institutions, I think, in creating a platform for these conversations to take place. One of the lessons that we took away from this is that if we really believe as ardently as we do in the power of modern art to shape the way we think, feel, and understand our world, then we need to start working with other museums elsewhere in the country, perhaps in areas that are less open to the ideas embedded in those great works of art that we have, and share our collections with them, share our thinking with them. I'm not naive enough to believe that we'll change people's minds overnight, but I do believe if you give people access to the most interesting art around and you give them the tools by which to understand that art, to interrogate it, they will ultimately come to their own decisions, but they'll be informed decisions. We may not convince everybody that the power of abstraction is as interesting as mimetic art. That's not the point. The point is that they are both languages that we should respect and know about, and that artists have a lot to teach us about the world.
Just take a quick step back to where, for you personally, the spark of an interest in art came from. Your expertise is in the art of the Islamic world. Where did that first catch your eye?
So it never occurred to me in a million years that I would be engaged with art. I went to university thinking that I was going to be a medical doctor. And somewhere in my freshman semester, I had an utter meltdown and realized that I just wasn't that interested in all of the different courses in biology and chemistry that were necessary for pre-med, and that actually everybody in the pre-med program looked just like me, and I didn't want to be around people who looked just like me. So I went to my college advisor, who said, well, you're at a liberal arts college. The whole purpose of a place like this is to take courses and subjects you know nothing about. So why don't you look at the course catalog and find what you don't know? So I didn't know anything about philosophy. I didn't know anything about religion. I didn't know anything about art history. And so I immediately enrolled in courses in religion, philosophy, and art history in the second semester of my freshman year. And I just happened to stumble into a course on Islamic and Indian art. Random. It was about as far from anything I knew as you could imagine. And there was a charismatic, indeed a brilliant teacher named Milo Beach, who literally, when the first slide went up and he started talking about it, I was seduced. I knew in that instant that what I wanted to do was to become an art historian like him and to study Indian and Islamic art. And I was lucky enough to be able to do that.
When you look at sort of artists and patronage, I suppose, today, you said that there'd been this shift from your point of view as the director of the Museum of Modern Art, from, say, an interest in artists, older artists, to huge white-hot kind of interest in contemporary and modern art. You know, what's the relationship like between an artist and a patron now? And where do institutions like the MoMA fit into that, would you say?
I think we're in an interesting moment when it comes to the value of contemporary art. The prices have exploded, interest has exploded, and everything in a way is being redefined and renegotiated. And of course, museums, as collecting institutions, are largely the beneficiary of gifts. We don't have the kind of funds that allow us to acquire extensively. And so as prices become ever higher, our opportunities diminish substantially. And so we rely to an ever greater degree on the generosity of donors. And those donors, in turn, are engaged in all sorts of relationships with artists and with dealers. And it's not clear to me that this level of activity can sustain itself forever. Now, what does that mean? 5 years, 10 years, 20 years? I'm a historian by training, so I know that nothing stays the same, and that just as the interest in old master drawings or Renaissance painting has waned, so too will the interest in modern and contemporary art as some other interest replaces it. And in the interim, we're all going to struggle with how to deal with the enormous valuation that people have placed on contemporary art, making it, first of all, much harder for people to acquire, much more difficult for institutions to evaluate, because when something's suddenly worth more than a Michelangelo, what does that actually mean? It's a very complicated moment. And I think every major museum, and maybe every museum in the world, struggles with how to balance the way in which the market has begun to shape thinking about various artists and the way we understand those artists. And there is it's not a one-to-one relationship.
What does that do to the artists that therefore sort of come to the fore? Is it a problem that, you know, money dictates kind of what is seen and what comes to the fore? Is that always how it's been, really?
Well, art and money have never been disassociated. It's simply that today the issues are far more acute. So if you're a young artist and suddenly your work goes from being worth $10,000 to $100,000 to $1 million to $10 million in a matter of a couple of years, and people now are investing in your art, and they have an expectation that their investment is going to continue to increase, and you're an artist and your goal isn't to worry about their investment. Your goal is to make the art that's most meaningful to you and that you believe in. There can be a lot of tension and pressure as you start to move in new and different directions, and your collectors want you to continue to produce the art that they like, right? That's just one of the many tensions that younger artists contend with. And I think the artists that succeed the most are the ones who can tune out the market. It's not that they're unaware of the value of what they're doing, but to tune out all that noise and to concentrate on making art that's meaningful and that has an authenticity to it that will survive whatever pressures and values, positively and negatively, the market puts on that art.
What are your hopes and sort of ambitions for MoMA as its director, would you say? Where are the opportunities bubbling up as you see them now on the horizon, do you say?
Well, I think the most interesting challenge for us and maybe for other museums of modern art is to evolve from institutions that think analytically to institutions that think digitally. And I don't mean by that simply the use of technology, because that's almost mechanical. I mean to think in a new and different way, to understand that the digital world creates a very different set of relationships, to think in a network way rather than in a hierarchical way, to think about sharing rather than possession, to think about enabling people to map their own direction rather than to show them the route they need to follow. They're just a whole different set of parameters that are involved with digital thinking that we need to understand, embrace, and find a way of making part of our DNA if we want to be successful 50 years from now.
The Big Interview is produced by Gaia Lutz and edited by Cassie Galpin. I'm Tomos Lewis. Thank you very much for listening.